On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. Who's the NBA MVP as of today? And does Cade Cunningham really deserve most improved player? And finally, what Kyrie Irving's injury means for the Dallas Mavericks? That and more coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I'm Tom Haberstroh, and as always, I'm joined by Dan Devine, your man, Dan Devine, our man, Dan Devine. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, Tom. Having a good day here. I'm ready to put up some numbers. You are coming to us from a different location, though, if I can point our YouTube viewers to notice this. Where can we say you're coming from this week?
Oh, an undisclosed hotel room in Portland, Oregon. It is a very dreary, very Portland day. Like this is straight off the set of Portlandia. It is dreary. It is cloudy. There's rain, like very ambiguous rain. Like you're like, oh, is that rain or mist? And that's basically Portland for you, Dan.
Is that rain or mist sounds like the worst party game? Just somebody walking around with like a little spritzer, like for their plants, and a ficus while you're just getting hammered. That's not what we're here to talk about this week, though, Tom. So why don't you lay it on me? What is this week's big number? Mist me with it or rain it on me, whichever one you choose.
I'm going to rain it on you. This week's big number, we're going to focus on the awards. We're going to do a little tease on where we think the awards ballots are for our personal selves at this juncture in the season. We're going to look at, for each of the awards, who is the favorite, whether we buy or sell. And the first award we're going to hit right here on the big number, which you can find, by the way, every week here on YouTube, wherever you listen to podcasts, Thursdays, usually. Sometimes even as early as Wednesday. But thank you for joining us. The big number this week is plus 750. That is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's plus minus this season, which is absurd. It's way higher than everybody else in the league, so much so that Nikola Jokic, who's on a lot of people's ballots, on the top of people's ballots right now in the juncture of the season, Nikola Jokic is at plus 519. That is second in the NBA, plus 519. Now, what does that mean? That means when Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is on the floor for the Oklahoma City Thunder, they are outscoring opponents by a whopping 750 points. And then with Jokic on the floor for the Denver Nuggets, they're plus 519 when he's on the floor. And my friends, you might be wondering, is that the largest lead in NBA history for
between
plus minus?
And two. Yeah.
And the answer is yes. Since plus minus has been calculated at the league level and became an official stat for us nerds since 1996-97 season, the largest lead entering this year was plus 192 Stephen Curry in 2017. And Shai has just completely demolished that. He's at plus 231, the largest lead in plus minus. And look, I'm not saying that the MVP vote should just go to plus minus. There's a lot of reasons why, you know, there's other factors that are contributing to that number. Namely, the supporting cast for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is superb, but they don't have an all-NBA counterpart, and neither does Nikola Jokic. And yet, one team is slated to have the best point diff in NBA history. If you haven't looked at the diff word in a while, diff man can't breathe. Diff man, the mascot of the big number here. We talked about it last week about the Cleveland Cavaliers, and yet Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and the Thunder are way higher than the Cleveland Cavaliers. Look, the scoring leader, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and also has a huge lead in the scoring column against the rest of the NBA, averaging over 32 points a game. He's dropping 50 points. He's dropping 40 points seemingly every night. The Thunder are awesome, but for two-way play, Dan, my vote is going for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. He's second in the NBA in steals. This is a team that lives on those forcing turnovers on the opponent, and he's excellent at swiping down or poking the ball out and running the fast break on the other way. And it's weird to say that I don't think it's particularly close in my book when Jokic has been so good this year. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander checks every box that we want out of an MVP. It's the win column, it's the on-court impact, it's the scoring, it's the team leadership. Everything to me is pointing to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and he is a deserving MVP candidate. What say you?
I mean, I would love to just come and completely riverside you here and say, like, no, wrong. You're totally wrong, as I blow out the mics. But, I mean, obviously, yeah, he's there. I mean, whichever sort of argument you would like to use, whichever framing of value you want to use, Shai's got a pretty great case for it. Here is where I do my, you know, cowardly caveats. I might wind up having a real vote again this year. I don't know for sure. I won't know for about a month and a half or so. If I do, do not say that I said this stuff and then hold me to it if I change it. Like, we're still 20 games left. Everybody be cool. Just be cool for like once, everybody, awards-wise. That's all I'm asking for. Best player on best team, check. Leading the league in scoring, check. Averaging prime Jordan numbers, 32.6 points, 5.2 rebounds, 6.2 assists. The only other player to hit 32, 5, and 6, Jordan, who did it three times. Of course he did. And doing it on like Steph-level efficiency, which is nuts. You mentioned the defensive bona fides there as one of the most important parts of one of the best defenses we've ever seen. Advanced statistical resume, up one or two and everything. So like there's no argument that Shai deserves a top spot on the ballot. The counter argument that I feel compelled to make here is like Jokic's season is also historically insane. Third guy on pace to become the third guy ever to average a triple double, doing so while on like dramatically higher efficiency than Oscar Robertson and Russell Westbrook were able to do it. He's creating 66.6 points per 36 minutes for the Nuggets. When you tally up is the points he scores, the points that he generates via assist, the points that he creates with his screening to open up other players. Shouts out to my man, Zach Cram, his points created metric. That's about 15 more than SGA per 36. So like a pretty sizable gap there. Even as SGA has been an incredible engine of offense, there's just nobody even touching the hem of the garment for Jokic at this point. You talked about some of the advanced stats. Jokic has the lead on SGA in true shooting percentage, player efficiency rating, win shares per 48 minutes, box plus minus, value over replacement player, estimated Raptor, Darko, LeBron. There's a lot. Jokic's advanced resume is like head and shoulders above everybody. And there's also just like the more with less component. As you said, neither Jokic nor SGA has an all NBA caliber running buddy. SGA does have an all-star running buddy in Jalen Williams. Jamal Murray was like actively bad for the first 20 games of the season. Aaron Gordon missed like 40% of the season, still hasn't played 1,000 minutes. There's only one other player on the roster that's been like a consistent net positive on both ends of the floor, which is Christian Brown. And Denver's still on pace for 52 wins and might be the 2 seed with a top 3 offense. And it's like all Jokic. So all that to say, I think reasonable people can disagree and reasonable people can make an argument in either direction. I don't know that it's an open and shut case, even as OKC runs away with the West. And I think Jokic has a pretty damn good argument to be made there, too. So I think if I was voting today, I probably would go for SGA for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. But the more I made the Jokic case, the more I was like, damn, would I really? And I think that's the challenge that a lot of voters are going to face themselves finding.
You heard it here first, folks. Dan Devine says Jokic is better than Michael Jordan and LeBron James and everybody else in NBA history. And you can put that on his ballot. He's already inked his ballot. So congratulations, Dan. Wow.
What's messed up is I have inked it, and it's like it's a website. Like they send you an email with a link to a website, and I'm written on the computer screen in ink.
Yeah.
The people at Yahoo are not thrilled about this. They're like, why did you screw up our equipment? We're not sending you a new one, you dullard. And that, I mean, maybe I should have my vote taken away or my computer taken away. Maybe that would be for the best for a lot of reasons. You mentioned a name there that I have said Jokic is better than. LeBron James. How's he doing this year? I think he's probably not anywhere near the MVP conversation, right?
I think he has a chance to get into the conversation. LeBron James right now isn't on BetMGM's MVP odd board. He's not even listed. Other sports books have him listed very long shot MVP odds. One I just saw has him plus 50,000 to win MVP this season.
Tom, that's a pretty big number. I don't know much about gambling, but I do know that that's a pretty big number.
That is like just begging for people to bet on LeBron James at plus 50,000. But I do think, like, dude, I think
you've sussed out the reasoning for it. Yeah.
It's just to like bait people into placing the bets. Like, there's a lot of people who are like, I can't even bet on LeBron James to win MVP. Help me out here. I will say LeBron James, you know, given the fact that he just caught huge headlines for being the first player ever to have 50,000 points in his NBA career, which I have noted is more than Dwayne Wade and Tracy McGrady's careers combined. Think about that. Two scoring champions combined. If you stack them end to end, there are 31 seasons that they've played in the NBA. D Wade and T Mac still are looking up in the points leaderboard at LeBron James, which is absurd. Also absurd is that they're currently on a 7-game win streak. And yeah, we just kind of forget about that Charlotte loss coming out of the All-Star break. It is amazing what LeBron James is doing. And I will say, I think that plus 50,000 is probably underrating his chances because of this fact. He has, on his remaining schedule, LeBron James has at Oklahoma City April 6th, at Oklahoma City April 8th. Also later this season, he's playing at Boston. If LeBron James and Luka and the Lakers sweep that, beating OKC twice in their building and beating the Boston Celtics in their building, I think the MVP chatter is going to get at a fever pitch. I think even if he does sweep those games, beating the best teams in the NBA in their building, I think you're going to see LeBron James get into the top three in MVP chatter. And right now he's off the board. But man, I think he's a big enough name. He's been healthy this season. He's playing at such a high level, averaging 28, 8 and 8 since he was 40 years old, which is absurd. And I think like he will build a case as the number two seed that has beaten OKC, that has beaten Boston in their building. If he does that, if he does all of that, then I think we can talk about him as a legitimate MVP candidate.
Well, first off, my first question is, do you think that they pegged the odds to the point total? They were like 50,000. That sounds like a good round number. Let's say, yeah, that's fine. That's the odds for him to win MVP. So maybe as he continues to progress, they'll even get worse. Yeah, I mean, listen, if you want to start making the case, two players in the NBA averaging 24, 8, and 8. One of them's Jokic, the other's LeBron James. He's 13th in the league in scoring, 6th in assists. Only Jokic has more triple-doubles. We talked about this on a previous episode of The Big Number. He's suddenly a 41% three-point shooter, career best. 4th in value over replacement player, top 10 in a few other advanced metrics. There's going to be a, if you're actually going to like lay out the case, you have to look at the fact that the Lakers have actually been outscored with him on the floor this season by about 0.4 points per 100 possessions, according to Cleaning the Glass. However, as again, shouts out to my man, Zach Cram, we're going to bring him back again the second time. He recently looked at it at ESPN. A lot of that variance is like shot variance, three-point shooting. His teammates missing a bunch of three-pointers when he's on the floor. The opponent's making a bunch of three-pointers when he's on the floor. And then that flipping when he's off. So like only so much you can control 3 points going in and going out, but LeBron has been on the bad side of that equation where that has really never happened for him before. And yeah, I mean, if they are the Lakers right now, they enter, as we're talking, they're the second seed in the Western Conference. If that continues, and you're talking about best player on the number two seed in the West and also very famous best player, that's a case that doesn't have to get laughed out of the room. My guess would be, just based on the seasons that SGA and Jokic have put together so far, based on what I think a lot of the voting electorate is likely to have considered like their aggregate accomplishments to this point, we're talking about like, can LeBron get up into 3, 4, 5 more so than can he get up to 1 or 2? But even that would be, I mean, setting aside the fact that what he's doing is like unthinkably impressive for someone who is 40, what he's doing would be impressive for anybody, full stop. And, you know, the idea that we're looking at another all-NBA caliber season for him is just bonkers. Also, we can't let the see the segment here pass without just saying, shouts out to Giannis. I wrote about this at Yahoo Sports last week, like the under the aegis of like, are his MVP days kind of over because of how Jokic has sort of jumped ahead, and SGA now rising up to join him. And the fact that even the insane stuff that Giannis is doing just doesn't me really go like, it's not quite as insane as what they were. Those guys are, he's averaging 30 points, 10 rebounds and 5 assists per game on 60% shooting. Nobody else in the history of the league has done that. And this is his second year in a row doing it. And he's basically just carrying the Bucks to, top 4 contention. Obviously Dame has been great as well, but like, he's been the one dragging him from a 2-8 start up to top 4 contention. So it might only get him up to third, but he deserves a mention at least. So here we are mentioning him. Shouts out to Giannis.
We're mentioning LeBron. We're mentioning Giannis Antetokounmpo. And I'll just mention here that the reason why I don't have Jokic closer to SGA in my MVP fake ballot, yours is real. Yours is set in stone. It's carved in marble. Mine, it's totally fake in the ether, as Kevin Calabro likes to say. Kevin Calabro on the broadcast, he thinks I'm working in like my mother's basement. So he always tells me like on the air, he's like, and coming to you live from his mother's basement, Tom Haberstroh, or it's somewhere in the ether. I don't know. But I can assure you, I'm in Portland.
Kevin, we gotta update those references. That's some old blog stuff. We've graduated. We've elevated. We've got professional microphones and everything now. It's great.
Yes, yes. Shout out to FJM, firejoemorgan.com, and Ken Tremendous right. for a lot of mother's basements references. Yeah. So here's Jokic. Here's what I'll say about him. They have a bottom 15 defense. They're below average defense in the True. NBA. It's not all on Jokic. I think some of it is systematic, just the principles that they have in Denver. I think it's also part of the reason why they don't want him to rim protect is because they want to get transition or just get the ball out faster. Don't want him to get in foul trouble because he's so valuable. They don't necessarily want him to be contesting at the rim and potentially fouling out or getting in foul trouble. But the facts are the facts. And when you look at the defensive field goal percentage at the rim when he's nearby, it's bottom 4 in the entire league. He's allowing 69% field goal percentage at the rim when he's nearby. And a lot of that is he's not even contesting it. Like, literally, he's got his hands down getting the ball out of the rim because he's like, I want to start this fast break and like create a good scoring opportunity. And yes, you would like to see him like burn a calorie on rim protection every once in a while, but he's third in steals. And so he is creating turnovers and forcing turnovers, even if he isn't Dikembe Mutombo out there. But bottom 5 in defensive field goal percentage at the rim, according to NBA.com stats player tracking. These names, you don't want to be associated with them defensively. You got Domantas Sabonis at 5, Jokic at 4, Karl-Anthony Towns at 3, Vooch at number 2, and Mark Williams, the guy who the Lakers were like, wait a minute, we actually don't want to bring him in onto the Lakers. I don't think it's because of that. Maybe it's because of that. Maybe they looked at his player tracking data on defense, and they were like, yeah, we're good. Dalton, come back. That's the thing with Jokic, is like, it's tough for me to overlook the fact that the Thunder have the best defense like ever in NBA history and an amazing offense. And we can see Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's fingerprints on all of that. And we have to mention that the Denver Nuggets defense is below average, and that's not what you want to see. Not totally his fault, but it is my fault that I haven't teased the little numbers yet, because I want to mention this, Dan. You've got 4 little numbers here, and you're going to hear our picks for all these awards: most improved player, 6th man of the year, coach of the year, defensive player of the year. We're going to buy or sell the favorite and see, Dan, whether you're buying or selling and whether I agree with the favorite. And we'll give our picks, quote unquote, for me, quote unquote, for you. It's set in stone, Dan. Coming up right after the break, after these messages. All right, Dan, I just wrote at tomthefinder.com why Tomani Kamara should be in the defensive player of the year conversation. That's my way of saying I don't know if he's Defensive Player of the Year, but he certainly should be considered. So it's a little bit of a cop-out there. But I think that Tamani Kamara is awesome, and he's not even on the board, just like LeBron James isn't even on the board at MGM for MVP odds. He's also not on the DPOY conversation or the odds for DPOY, and I think that's insane. He is so good. And Evan Mobley, the other night, he took a charge on Evan Mobley. And later Mobley was ejected, disqualified because he had six fouls. And a big reason why is Tamani Kamara is awesome at doing those. He's second in the NBA in stops, 180 in the league. And Dyson Daniels is number one in defensive stops, which considers blocks recovered, steals, and offensive fouls drawn. But the guy who's number one overall in the odds, the most likely, is neither Dyson Daniels or Tamani Kamara. Who is it, and is he the subject of your first little number?
You know that he is, Tom, because you can look at the Google Doc. Our first little number today is 107. 107. That is the Cleveland Cavaliers defensive rating with Evan Mobley on the court this season. That is the 12th lowest individual number, so individual defensive rating, among 197 players averaging at least 24 minutes a game. So all the guys playing more than half the game, that is number 12 there. This is notable because you're like, 12, that doesn't sound like one, right? Six of the 11 players ahead of Mobley won't get to 65 games this season. You got Chet Holmgren, Jalen Suggs, Isaiah Hartenstein, Franz Wagner, you know, benefiting from the ecosystem in Orlando. Derek Lively in Dallas, Jabari Smith Jr., again, ecosystem in Houston. Also, guys like Alex Caruso, Ausar Thompson, Victor Wembanyama, the odds-on favorite before he got hurt. Those guys are not going to get there. They're some of the players that are ahead of Evan Mobley in defensive estimated plus-minus. So Evan Mobley winds up, you know, the Cavs are not a number one or number two defense. I believe they're seventh in points allowed per possession entering our conversation here. But he's eighth in the NBA in total blocks. He's 23rd in defensive field goal percentage allowed at the rim among guys who've defended at least 150 shots. It's not overwhelming. And yet, he is now the favorite for Defensive Player of the Year. Tom, are you buying Evan Mobley as the favorite for this award?
Dan, I hate this award this year. I hate it. It should go to the Thunder, someone on the Thunder. But collectively, like, you can't point to one player being the face of that defense, right? Secondly, I think if there was no 65 game rule, this would go to Wemby. I really believe that he has done so much defensively to warrant his... He is the best defender in the NBA, and I don't think it's particularly close. And when you point out all of the guys who are not going to be eligible, I think it speaks to the fact that the 65 game rule should be abolished. We're already considering how many games or minutes you're playing in the award, and I think Evan Mobley is the default candidate here. Like, I don't
default, you ran through default. The default. Default.
Default DPOY. Like, there's going to be a chant there somewhere. But this, clap, like, Dan, clap, doesn't clap, it, clap. Yeah, doesn't this, like, scream, I don't know, like, this doesn't feel right to me. Like, Evan Mobley is not elite in any particular category, and I would say, like, elite of the elite. He's good in a lot of categories, but I can't give him the DPOY or have him as the favorite in my book when I'm not so sure he's the best defender, like, he's a great defender, but Jared Allen is the five on that team. So you can't even say like the rim protection numbers should be given to Evan Mobley or give him credit for it because a lot of the time he's on the floor with another big. I'm having a hard time with Defensive Player of the Year this year. And if I had to give it to somebody, if it's not Wemby or if it's not just the Thunder, I would probably give it to Amen Thompson. We've spent an entire episode talking about Amen and the fact that he was getting triple doubles and gaining a lot of responsibility offensively and just being awesome this year. Go back and listen to it if you haven't already. He's 10th in stops. He's on a team that's top five in defensive rating. The Rockets could be basically in like a week, they could be number two defensively. It's that close after the Thunder. He's 15th in recovered blocks. He's 18th in steals. And if you look at like Lu Dort, if you look at Tamani Kamara, Dyson Daniels, Amen Thompson has a really strong on-court defensive rating. It's at 108.9. Tamani Kamara is at 113. Dyson Daniels is at 115. So even if you want to say Dyson Daniels, look at, he's lapping the field in steals. Well, it is kind of odd that with all of those steals and all that great on-court production from Dyson Daniels, and what a game-winning play against the Memphis Grizzlies earlier this week. But the Hawks aren't good at defense. And they haven't been for quite a while. And when Dyson Daniels is on the floor, it's not a great defensive rating. So even if I wanted to say Tamani Kamara and Dyson Daniels, I don't have a compelling argument from a team defensive rating standpoint. So I feel bad about the Defensive Player of the Year. And maybe I'm getting defensive about it, but it seems like this is Wemby or OKC's award. And we'll look back being like, how did Evan Mobley win this award when the Cavs weren't even top five defensively and he wasn't a juggernaut shot blocker? And yes, he's got versatility, but you can't look at Evan Mobley and say he's more versatile than Tamani Kamara, more versatile than Lou Dort, or who got, these guys guard one through five. And Evan Mobley does that occasionally, but not to the same extent as some of these other guys. So to me, Amen Thompson checks more boxes than anybody else in the group. And so for me, he would be in pencil DPOY favorite for me.
You heard it here first. Ivica Zubac for Defensive Player of the Year. It's the only option left to us.
I'm not hating that pick, by the way. I'm not hating that pick. He's awesome.
Now that we've hated on the Cleveland Cavaliers sufficiently enough that Mike Goldfarb wants to leave the call, our second little number today is +25.1. That is the year-over-year change in winning percentage for your Cleveland Cavaliers. Cavs finished last season at 48-34, 585 winning percentage. They enter Wednesday's games at 51-10, an 836 winning percentage, which would give them the sixth highest winning percentage in NBA history. 70 wins still on the table. To be a long shot, but 70 wins still on the table. A dramatic transformation from good to historically great has first-year head coach Kenny Atkinson as the heavy favorite to win Coach of the Year honors. I'm wondering, how does that sound to you, Tom? Coach of the Year typically goes to either a runaway one seed or the biggest turnaround in the league. The Cavs are the former. What do you think about this year? Do you think that should be, hold the water in the Coach of the Year conversation?
Yeah, I feel better about this one going to the Cavs. I think Kenny Atkinson deserves it. I think JB Bickerstaff has an excellent case. I think Chauncey Billups should get a lot more. And yes, you can call me a homer with the Blazers pick, but you know which team was the first team?
You're just
to
misting
exceed?
The homerism. You're just misting it, not raining it.
Not raining. This is a mist. Chauncey Billups was the first coach to exceed the preseason win-loss projection by Vegas. It wasn't Detroit. It wasn't Brooklyn. Fernandez doing a great job over there in Brooklyn. It was the Portland Trailblazers. They beat their over-under first among all the teams, and they did it February 4th. He deserves credit. J.J. Redick is going to get some votes here, and deservedly so. I'm probably missing like three other coaches that should be in the running. But to me, Kenny Atkinson, you can't point to an acquisition, an off-season acquisition or a remodel of the roster around Cade Cunningham, for example, as a reason why they vastly improved. He basically took the same team with the same players as last year, mostly, and recreated the offense and made Evan Mobley, in my opinion, a great two-way star. That doesn't mean that he's the Defensive Player of the Year, but I do think what we're doing this season is almost, we're giving other awards to players that maybe we think are representative of a team turnaround. And I think the team turnaround should be going to the Coach of the Year rather than just like splicing it into the individual awards. That's a tease for later in this program. So I think Kenny Atkinson, the fact that you go from like a 50-win team to a potentially 70-win team, that's harder than going from a 20-win team to a 40-win team. And that's why, in my book, he's Coach of the Year.
I hear all that, Tom, and that's sound, reasoned logic. It's respectful. It's respectable. I'm a messy dude who loves drama, though, Tom. So I'm going to go the other way and say that the guy that Kenny Atkinson replaced, the guy fired so Kenny Atkinson could get this job, is the one who deserves it. Here's the problem with +25.1, our second little number. It is not the largest year-over-year change in winning percentage. 39.4. That is the largest change in winning percentage this year. And that is your fight in Detroit Pistons. they've already won 21 more games than they did last season. And maybe some of the credit for this belongs to Monty Williams. But the Pistons are fighting for home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs for the first time in 17 years. Like, there's going to be, I don't know, was Cooper Flagg alive the last time the Pistons had first home court advantage in the first round? The most dramatic single season turnaround in the league. Again, that is often the kind of thing that gets a coach of the year notice, or, you know, that at least lands you high on that ballot. The Pistons have been one of the best stories in the league all season long, and one that I think very rarely did people see coming. I think you could have seen before the season, like, all right, the Cavs had, I think, like three of their four main guys last year, Darius Garland, Donovan Mitchell, Evan Mobley, all missed big time. They had a lot of injuries. Ty Jerome basically didn't play last season. They had all these guys that they expected to be parts of their team were not there. Those guys, if they're healthy, that why isn't that a 55-win team? Obviously, they are way more than that, and Kenny Atkinson deserves a lot of credit. I don't think anybody saw the Pistons fighting for a four seed. So to me, like, maybe that doesn't necessarily rise to the qualitative evaluation of this is a better coaching job, but I do think it merits consideration and merits reward. So if I had to make that choice today, I probably would go with J.B. Bickerstaff, if for no other reason than I think it would be pretty funny to see him wind up finishing above the guy who wound up taking his job. But that's neither here nor there. And yeah, you're right. There's probably a bunch of other people that we're forgetting. Coach of the Year is one of those where you could name 15 different people and you'd have a good argument for it. So everybody that we didn't name, we're heartily sorry for having offended thee.
I agree with what you're saying about the turnaround. I just think then you vote Trajan Langdon for Executive of the Year, because the Malik Beasley acquisition, the Tobias Harris acquisition, and the Tim Hardaway Jr. acquisition, those three pieces have been huge in spacing the floor, getting shooters around Cade Cunningham. Seems to me like a great case for Executive of the Year. And yes, J.B. Bickerstaff, I'm not trying to say that he doesn't deserve credit. I'm just saying, in terms of Coach of the Year, give me the guy in Cleveland that turned a team that I, and certainly others, didn't even think they'd be remotely close to winning a title this season, and turning them into basically threatening to win 70 games. That's outstanding. So what else you got on little number?
Third little number this week is six, a pretty small number, really. That's how many players in the NBA this season are averaging at least 13 points, 3 rebounds, and 3 assists per game with an effective field goal percentage over 600. Now, that sounds like a pretty thin slice. Going to explain it to you. Effective field goal percentage, if you're not initiated, it's a stat that adjusts a player's shooting percentage for the fact that three-pointers are worth more than two. You make more threes, that number is going to go up. There's only six players in the league that hit those numbers we were talking about, 13, 3, and 3, EFG over 600. Five of them are starters. And then there's the sixth, Peyton Pritchard of the Boston Celtics, who is the odds-on favorite right now for sixth man of the year. He's the heavy favorite. I think I'm buying it. We could talk about some of the numbers. Why? I'm wondering, where are you on that conversation? Do you think that Peyton Pritchard is a deserving favorite for that award? Or is this just kind of typical Boston media mafia stuff? Like, you get a Celtic out there. They got an HBO Max series. They're winning sixth man of the year. Where do you stand on the Peyton Pritchard of it all, Tom?
All right, I'll give you a little number here. Zero, that's the number of games started by Peyton Pritchard, and that's the reason why he's sixth man of the year. If I become the NBA czar, if I become commissioner, it's one of my rules, even though sixth man of the year is not a huge deal, I do think that if you start any game, you're ineligible for sixth man of the year. Give me zero starts next to your name. If you want to be considered for sixth man of the year, it's not majority of your games you're coming off the bench. I want all of your games coming off the bench. The fact that we have a sixth man of the year award is kind of weird in the first place. It's basically like, who is the best player who's not good enough to start any games? Then give me someone who has zero starts. Otherwise, I'm not having it. Malik Beasley, love your season. The fact that you're, you know, up there with the best shooters in the NBA, fantastic. But you didn't have a zero in the game started column. You started a bunch of games this year. Same thing with DeAndre Hunter. Same thing with the guy from Cleveland. I want, for my pure sixth man of the year award, I want a pure zero starts for sixth man of the year. You're not the fifth man of the year. So then why are you starting games? I want anyone who's eligible for sixth man of the year to have zero starts. And Peyton Pritchard, I see you. I see you with your end of quarter heaves. I see you. You're the most ethical player in the NBA. I love it. You go for it. I love the heaves. I love that you're going for sixth man of the year with zero starts, even though Jaylen Brown and Drew Holiday, they've all missed a bunch of games this year, and he still is true to the sixth man of the year. I applaud you, Peyton Pritchard, and I am going to hand you my fake ballot with your name on the top of the sixth man of the year. There you go.
It's a pure, I love the purity test there. For what it's worth, the Celtics have outscored opponents by 9.4 points per 100 possessions with Pritchard on the floor. Third best net rating among any reserve, getting 20 minutes a game. So they've been awesome with him on the floor. Last year, it was all about their starting lineup. This year, that lineup hasn't been so hot. When he gets into the game, that's when they really hit the gas. So Celtics, still a title contender, still one of the favorites to come out of the East. He has been a huge part of that team. I think it's a reasonable thing. Although, Malik Beasley, we do love your hip wiggle. We love your little shimmy. It's important to celebrate the good things in the world, and that's certainly one of them. Other guys whose names, just to say names because it's fun to say names. DeAndre Hunter, was there in Atlanta, now in Cleveland. Still not starting regularly there. Naz Reid, just two words, Naz Reid, always fun to say. Santi Aldama, Caris LeVert. There's plenty of good options here, but I think you're probably going to wind up talking about Peyton Pritchard there. And our fourth and final little number, 2.7, even smaller than six, even littler than that. That is Cade Cunningham's value over replacement player this season, 2.7. VORP is a stat that looks at how many points per 100 team possessions a player contributes over like an imaginary substitute that's replacement level that we consider like, you can take or leave that guy. How much better are you than that imagined guy? Let's call him Dan Devine. Like if you had a guy you could just take or leave, replace, nobody would miss him. How much better are you than that? Cade Cunningham, 2.7 this year. That is more than doubled year over year. So he was 1.2 last year, 2.7 this year, and that's up from 0.2 in his rookie season. So that, now if I'm thinking about it on a chart, that's improvement, right? That's going up. We did a whole episode on Cade Cunningham a few weeks back. He's averaging more assists and more points per 36 minutes. Assist to turnover ratio is up. Effective field goal percentage and true shooting is up. He's knocking down pull-up threes. He's automatic in the mid-range. He has, by most measurements, improved to the point where he's now like an all-star, maybe an all-NBA guy. He is, as it stands, the favorite to win most improved player. He was also, we should remember, the number one pick in the draft. So Tom Haberstroh, where do you sit with all of that? Can somebody who's at that elevated place when he gets into the league be considered an MIP, or should that award be going someplace else?
I'm afraid to say what I'm about to say because I forget whether I argued for Cade Cunningham for most improved player in our episode. Did I say
let's
that?
Let's delete the part where I said we had an episode about that. Forget it. Forward, never backward.
Never happened. It never happened. And the more I consider it, the more I feel like number one picks should not be eligible for most improved. It goes against the spirit of the award. I think that what we are doing here is trying to give an award to an underdog, someone, a scrappy dude that you didn't know was going to make it in the league. And then suddenly he makes himself into a really good NBA player. And to me, what Cade Cunningham being the favorite is more about his, let's just say, I don't want to say disappointing start to his career, but I think it's more about what he wasn't doing to start his career, less about what he's doing this year. And I feel like we're also giving him this award, or, you know, fashioning this award for Cade Cunningham, because I feel like voters are like, yeah, we can't give JB Bickerstaff the coach of the year because that's going to Kenny Atkinson. So can we give something to the Pistons because they deserve credit for their big, amazing story this season? And so let's give Cade Cunningham the most improved player. I feel like the guy who fits the most improved, I guess, in spirit, even though it's not a written in stone or any sort of like codified that you have to pick a guy who was barely in the league and then good, I feel like the spirit of the award, it should go to Ty Jerome. Ty Jerome was basically out of the league. He was bouncing around the G League, 10-day contract here, G League here, and didn't play last year with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Injuries, all that aside, Ty Jerome is a really good NBA player this year. He's 36th in EPM, estimated plus minus, over at dunksandthrees.com. He's got 10 20-point games. I happened to watch him lead the Cavaliers to victory the other day in overtime when Donovan Mitchell was hurt. Or resting for the game. Darius Garland was caught up in the Temani Kamara torture chamber, and Ty Jerome led the Cavs to victory. It wasn't Evan Mobley. He fouled out earlier in the game, and throughout the season, he has been the best guy on a loaded bench and oftentimes just the best player on the floor for long stretches of the game. Ty Jerome is awesome. He's great. You want to know who's in the 50-40-90 club this year? If he made just one more free throw, it's Ty Jerome. Ty Jerome went from out of the NBA to being in the same group as Larry Bird, Steve Nash, Kyrie Irving, and Stephen Curry in the 50-40-90 club. He makes one more free throw and he will be in the 50-40-90 club, shooting 51% from the floor, 44%. He's top five in steal rate and 3-point field goal percentage, and he's 89.7% from the free throw line as of this recording. Ty Jerome, it shouldn't even be close. Ty Jerome for most improved player of the year. And scene.
I love that. I'm on board for any and all Ty Jerome love. I think you mentioned just all these awards are getting sort of thrown into upheaval by who's eligible and who's not. What are the criteria? What are not? Also, just so if any listeners are wondering, like, it feels like the criteria are all over the place. So the voters decide they like one thing one year and one thing another year. For the record, the criteria you get when the NBA sends you an email is like, here is a link. Vote for the player that you think deserves it. That's it. There's no like list of things you got to consider. It's like whatever you bring in with you to the voting booth is what the criteria are. So that's why it might seem like it's all over the place. I think you're probably going to see a lot of support for Tyson Daniels. You mentioned him earlier in the Defensive Player of the Year conversation.
Great call.
Somebody who was like a deep reserve in New Orleans and now is like, he has a nickname. He's so cool at defense. You don't really get that all that often. Probably going to see Christian Brown, somebody who went from like a reserve role to like a main starter on a playoff bound Nuggets team and like leading the league in fast break points. And what happened to KCP? Who knows? Norm Powell, I think the candidacy fell off a little bit when he picked up some injuries. The Clippers have tailed off, but certainly an incredible season for him. Yeah, you're going to see some of these names. I like the idea. I'm formulating my feelings about should guys that were high draft picks be able to be eligible for this thing. Cause I think the hardest thing to do in the league is to go from like okay to superstar. But I think somebody who does what Ty Jerome Knight did will say, you know what the hardest thing to do in the league is? Stay in the league and get good. And I think there's a pretty good argument to be made for that.
Ty Jerome, a living embodiment of the great market inefficiency in Cleveland, is if you played for the Cavaliers at Virginia, you should play for the Cavaliers in Cleveland. He and DeAndre Hunter double up on the Cavs. And that is the secret to winning a championship, is just get Cavs players in college and bring them over to the Cavs. Underrated market inefficiency. Michael Lewis, where are you? Write about that one. The Cavs ball or Cavaliers ball is the new market inefficiency. I think you made great points about Tyson Daniels, Christian Brown. Those, it makes sense in my head why they would be getting most improved player, because they're really good NBA players today. And you weren't even a bet to make an NBA roster a couple of years ago. And that to me is in the spirit of the award. I think that's it for our awards. I'll just give a shout out to Steph Castle. I think he should be the favorite for Rookie of the Year. He's done an outstanding job. We did an episode on Zach Edey. I think Zach Edey could end up winning it down the stretch here for the Memphis Grizzlies, or Jalen Wells and his teammate over on the Memphis Grizzlies could win it. It's close, but what Castle's done with the injury to Wembanyama and taking over basically that team over the last couple weeks, awesome. I love Stephen Castle's game. So Rookie of the Year, in my book so far, Stephen Castle. But anything else?
I don't want to say anything more about award stuff, because I'm starting to get anxious about needing to write the column about it. So let's just take a break, collect ourselves, and maybe we'll see what you want to talk about on the other side of these commercials. What do you say, Tom?
Yeah, I'm going to give you such an uplifting story to talk about, is Kyrie Irving and his torn ACL. So, Dan, right after this break, we're going to get into the over-unders, a little check-in on that, and we'll talk about where the Mavs go from here. Okay, so the good news, certainly for me, is that I have I've come back officially. It is a tie in the over-under scoreboard, Dan.
News. I don't like
it's
that.
Great news. It's what I when I woke up this morning, instead of getting a coffee, I just stared at the scoreboard here, 17-17. It got me started in the day. And I will say that Zach Edey, we just talked about him. Zach Edey, he is maybe going to decide the season-long battle between me and you in the over-under competition, because right now it's 17-17. Zach Edey, we had as an over-under category of 4.5 fouls per 36 minutes. And as of this recording, Dan, he is at 4.48. I said the under, you said the over. And so I am getting that point. It flipped right there. And that is the reason why the gap has closed. And I will say also, Isaiah Hartenstein, stop taking threes. Stop taking threes. Actually, you know what? I'll say you should take maybe zero more, because I want you to be the under on your 3-point field goal attempt rate per 36 minutes. Right now it's 0.435. Our over under was 0.4. You took the over. He's 0 for 14 from downtown. You know what? Mark Daigneault, just say, yeah, no more. We're good. You don't have to take any more threes. I know you don't want to finish with zero in the 3-point field goal percentage column, but if he doesn't take any more threes and he continues to play, I will cash in that over under. I took the under at 0.4 and he's at 0.435. Dan, we're at a stalemate here. We're at a tie. That's the update on over unders. We'll see how it goes going forward. Going forward, the news came out that Kyrie Irving tore his ACL. I think we all, when we saw that injury in real time, that was what we feared. And it's what every Mavs fan feared, is that this decision by Nico Harrison to trade Luka Doncic, the future of the franchise, the current of the franchise, 25-year-old, five-time first All-NBA, took your team to the NBA Finals. Trading him accelerated your timetable to like the next couple years. And he even said it. In the press conference or in the quotes to ESPN's Tim McMahon, was like, we're on a 3-4 year timeline right now. I might not even be a GM here in the next decade. Who knows, Jason? Crazy quotes. And one thing that really, in a weird way, if I was running PR for the Dallas Mavericks, I would say to Nico Harrison, stop talking about the Laker greats. Just stop. When he did this quote here, and Kyrie Irving and how he, a little tribute and words of encouragement and support for Kyrie Irving, it started off fine. And then at the end, he says his work ethic and absolute dedication to his craft, it's cut from the cloth of greats. I know it, I lived it, and I see the same ferocity and passion in him that I saw in Kobe. Dan, this needs to stop. You traded Luka Doncic to the Lakers, and now you're associating your injured player as Kobe Bryant. I don't think Dallas Mavericks fans need this anymore. You're already being portrayed as like a secret agent for the Los Angeles Lakers, gifting Luka Doncic and bringing Luka Doncic to them in trade talks, and then having yourself out negotiated in terms of picks coming from the other side, and Rob Pelinka giving Rob Pelinka credit in your press conference for absorbing Luka Doncic. And now he's saying, you know what he reminds me of, Kyrie Irving, is Kobe Bryant. I don't think this is a good idea. I think he needs to stop giving credits or associating the greatness of his players and giving it over to the Lakers. It's not helping the perception that you are a secret agent for the Los Angeles Lakers and the purple and gold. It's not helping that. Dan, this is already, in my opinion, the worst trade in NBA history. And it was even before Kyrie Irving got hurt. It is unfortunate, but it is emblematic of the process being, I think, a dubious one. The idea that we are going to trade a 25-year-old coming into his prime and double down on two players, Kyrie Irving and Anthony Davis, who have a very checkered injury history, and doubling down and saying, we are going to try to win now and give up our future asset in Luka Doncic. And this is the problem. This was the worst case scenario, but it was a lot closer to just a realistic scenario, is that Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving would get hurt in that, right after that Luka Doncic trade. And it's unfortunate for Kyrie Irving. I know he'll come back strong. I don't need to compare this to Kobe Bryant to make the Mavs fans feel better about this thing. I do not think that is going over very well. And I don't think that Nico Harrison needs to make any more public statements about this team. Just sit back and build for the future. This has been bad.
I agree with the take that this has been bad. I don't think that I get where Nico Harrison's coming from in that, like, I want to lionize this player, especially, I mean, he can't avoid, or it is unavoidable to make a connection to Kobe Bryant when you know, Kyrie comes back and shoots the free throws. And that is an indelible memory that we have of after Kobe's Achilles tear, him coming back. And there was a natural connection that everybody was making. You perhaps do not need to further explicate it in the moment of your press release and official statement. I agree with that. I think the argument was always going to be like, or the glass half full argument was, this gives us a better chance to win the championship now. And that was the argument that Nico Harrison forwarded. We are still going to be good enough on offense. Our defense is going to be incredible. We're going to be gigantic, and we are going to be formidable. And in the space since then, you've lost every big player you have. You have lost Caleb Martin, you brought in to be like the combo forward because Quentin Grimes was suddenly surplus to requirements because you brought in Max Christie. So who needs 2 3-and-D2 guards? And then Caleb Martin hasn't played and Quentin Grimes is going for 40. And now you lose Kyrie Irving. So, I mean, it is like there is no redeeming. The best potential redemption here, I suppose, is do what the Mavericks did a couple of years ago, and when everything was going down the tubes, just expedite the tube going and steer into the skid and try to get the best lottery pick you can get, because then you can turn that into maybe, you know, turn it to Derek Lively, and that worked out real well. And so maybe there's something to be said for that. But in the case specifically of Kyrie Irving, like, this is absolutely devastating for a player this deep into his career at this age to suffer a significant injury like this, that's with a, you know, 8-9 month recovery period that's going to take you deep into next season too. He was also, you know, had the opportunity to opt out of his contract this summer. I think the expectation was, after everything happened with the Luka trade, he's going to opt out and they are going to lock him up long term on a new max deal because he's now the engine of everything offensively. This throws that into, I would have to imagine, some level of chaos, or it doesn't, in which case Nico Harrison is about to, I think, make an even more unpopular decision with the people of Dallas. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just, this is like, you know, bad scene. Nobody comes out looking good. And the Mavericks now find themselves in a position where they have a three-game cushion on 11th. So they're in 10th in the play-in picture. The Suns are underneath them. The Blazers are underneath them. There's a 3-game cushion with, you know, 20 odd games to go. They've got like a middle of the road schedule difficulty the rest of the way. They might not be able to be bad enough to get out of the play-in, but they're probably also like, they're not going to be able to score enough to move up. This is you are locked into a no man's land. And I don't know. I mean, it's hard to find the positives. I feel like I try to pride myself on finding something to get excited about for pretty much everybody. That is a tall task for the Mavericks right now. And I mean, I don't know. Do you have anything, yeah, Tom? Do you have a silver lining for me? Are we going to get real excited about Omax Pros? I don't know. What do we got?
Max Christie, maybe. I mean, if we're at the Max Christie stage of like, this is not a good situation. But I would also say, like, this was another missed opportunity when Patrick Dumont, who's the governor of the team, makes some quotes about like, hey, we want guys who work really hard, like Michael Jordan. And he listed off like 4 different names of all-time greats and didn't mention Dirk Nowitzki. It's read the room, man. Read the room. Same thing with this statement. And I keep going back. It's like, don't conjure up Kobe, who is the star player of the Lakers that you just gifted Luka Doncic, and maybe mention we'd like Kyrie Irving to have a long career deep into his 30s and 40 years old, like Dirk Nowitzki. Like, try to.
That would have been good. It's a good edit. Yeah.
And I'm not even a Mavs fan, but it just feels like, you know, you could use some amazing players in your franchise history to point to Kyrie Irving instead of the Laker guy, maybe point it to Dirk Nowitzki, who was at the Lakers game for Luka Doncic's debut for the Lakers, because kind of felt bad for Luka Doncic. And it's just, it feels like there's a better way to handle this situation. I think going forward for the Mavs, I'm looking at the possible contract extension that they could offer Kyrie Irving and thinking maybe they're going to do a Klay Thompson deal here where they're still going to max him or somewhat max him, get close to the max, even though he's injured, in the same way that the Golden State Warriors felt like they owed it to Klay Thompson after his ACL tear in the finals. There is precedent here for a team, even though a player is coming off an ACL injury, that they are like, you know what? You've done a lot for us, and we want to extend a monster deal anyway for you. There is a possibility that Nico Harrison, reading that quote, I think you can read into it to say that they would like to lock him in long term, despite the ACL injury. And it feels like to me, they will look at this situation and saying they're going to double down here rather than blow it all up and say,
what else is there to do, right? Like, I mean, if at this point in the transaction structure, you know, if you're not going to try to build, unless you're going to say, well, screw it, I guess we'll trade AD and figure it out, you know, and there's like blow it all up, which it doesn't seem like that's the direction they want to go. So it's like, it is the, you know, Slim Charles in The Wire. If it's a lie, then we fight on that lie. And it kind of feels like that's where the Mavs are right now.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Slim Charles, I would actually liken the situation to Slim Reaper in Phoenix, where they're doubling down on probably a bad bet, is that this team is going to turn things around. And they are so cornered with Bradley Beal in that contract that I think the Dallas Mavericks, by doubling down on Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving coming off the ACL tear, I think that they could be next year's Phoenix Suns, where it's just like, why did you put yourself in this corner here? And, it all starts with the Luka Doncic trade. And by the way, Casey Smith, former head athletic trainer for the Dallas Mavericks, letting him go and having him be on the New York Knicks now. Also a questionable decision, considering that the Dallas Mavericks have the most injury riddled second half of the season in the NBA. So this is not a good situation. But this is kind of the bed that Nico Harrison made when he traded away Luka Doncic to the Los Angeles Lakers. Certainly want the best for Kyrie Irving, but the way that the Mavs have handled this situation, subpar. And silver lining, Max Christie. Cool.
We've got that.
And we've also got the big number coming next week. I've got to go cover this Blazers end of their road trip here against the Celtics and the Thunder. So lots of Thunder talk in this episode. And I can't wait to watch Peyton Pritchard, six manning out there. Even if, you know what, if they don't have half their team, I really hope Pritchard comes off the bench still. And that will be the clear
sign. The purity
sign
of the O. You got to do it. The purity of the O demands it.
That's right. Dan, thanks so much for hanging today. We'll catch everyone next week. I want to give a shout out to the producers behind the scenes who make this show possible. Thanks to Stone, Mike, and the entire team behind the scenes. Please watch The Big Number on YouTube. Catch it wherever you get your podcast. And please subscribe, rate, and review. Give us that 5-star rating. And we will be back next week with another episode of The Big Number. Until then, be safe, be responsible, and enjoy award season.